journalist Steven Silverman's new book, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them, is the electrifying, never-before-told history of amusement parks from the Middle Ages to present day, populated by the colorful and sometimes shady characters who built them and the pleasure-seeking crowds who ceaselessly sought their magical, if all too fleeting, charms. The name of the new book is The Amusement Park. It is published by Black Dog and Leventhal, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Steven Silverman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thank you.
This book is so much fun and is just glorious, and there's so many things I want to get to and ask you about. The one thing that I will say that had me just interested from the very moment I picked up the book when I got it in the mail is this idea of 900 years. Give us a sense of the dating of the amusement park.
It wasn't a typo. Around 1122 in England, King Henry I's jester convinced the king that St. Bartholomew had come to him in a dream, and the king was very superstitious. The king was also mourning the loss of his son in a shipwreck. And the court jester was a social climber, and he thought if he could put together a fair in honor of St. Bartholomew, it would elevate his position. And, well, in fact, we got Bartholomew's Fair. It ran for 700 years, and it essentially is the first amusement park. There was entertainment, there was food, there were even very primitive rides. So there we begin.
And does at some point it become mostly an American tradition?
It does. I mean, there were rides. Catherine the Great had a major hand in the development of the roller coaster. The French then perfected it, put wheels on it so the coaster could roll. But it was the 1893 Chicago World's Fair and the success of the Midway, and there was the Ferris wheel, and there was the belly dancer Little Egypt. But there were, you know, and there was a roller coaster, and it was this idea of rides within a confined space. And that was perfected by the Americans. And the Americans, really, they didn't take from France with their roller coasters. We developed roller coasters on our own. It was a fellow named LaMarcus Thompson, who had been a garment manufacturer in the Midwest, had a nervous breakdown, and was a very religious man, and thought, well, if I can develop this mechanical thrill ride that went all of 6 miles an hour, people, men and women, wouldn't do that sinful thing, dance.
How much of this story is based on the rides themselves, and how much is based on the sideshow?
The development of the amusement park?
Yes, and the popularity.
Well, it was the rides that drew the crowds. And as is still happening today, every year the rides had to be updated and become even greater thrills. The sideshows developed, those were taken from carnivals, and amusement parks really stayed away from them because they the local authorities frowned upon them. But what happens with so many amusement parks, whether it was arson or accident, there were fires. And, you know, so the rides burn down. So what do they do on the property? They throw up a tent, and they quickly throw together sideshows. In Coney Island, eventually, the sideshow became so popular, you know, it remained. But amusement parks, basically, the main draw were the rides.
With that, there are the classics, right? So you mentioned the roller coaster. And is that the one that every park really had to have?
Yeah. It was the main course at the banquet. It wasn't dessert. It wasn't the appetizer. It was, you know, the real thing. And it anchored the park. And I identified the park. The roller coaster really came into being because there were simple amusement parks. And they were built by the railroad barons. In 1910, America had 2,000 amusement parks. The entire country was blanketed with them. And they were the mass entertainment before even the movies. But then people got tired of these simple rides. And then when Henry Ford introduced the Model T, everyone had a car. So they were getting their own thrills behind the wheels of their own cars. As a result, clever entrepreneurs thought, we'll supersize the thrill. And that's how we got the golden age of the roller coaster, which was really the 1920s.
You mentioned a moment ago, there is always this updating. These rides always have to be updated.
Right.
But then there are those classics that have been around. I mean, the obvious one, of course, is the Cyclone. That is that just sort of defies all of that. That is the classic and still has to be tamed and ridden today.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it was 2 years ago, the track was redone. I mean, it wasn't reconfigured or anything, but it was updated. It was smoothed out. So, you know, these things can't remain in their original state. This is problematic. Wooden coasters are very costly and difficult to maintain. And we're going to start seeing extinctions very soon. I mean, they're almost dinosaurs, but they are the classic. A Ferris wheel is a classic, and yet right now isn't as popular as it used to be. Several parks, like the Santa Cruz Boardwalk, they're replacing their Ferris wheel with other rides. And dark rides, you know, come and go. But, more and more now, what we're going through, and, you know, heaven help the people who can ride them, are, you know, the ones that will twist and turn you upside down and backwards and back up and down again. That's what's popular now.
How trendy is this business in the sense of what is popular now will be popular in 20, 30 years?
There'll be continual updating. I mean, the small parks, the family-owned parks, you know, they're holding on, whether based on charm, tradition. But, you know, the big destinations remain Disney World, Disneyland, Cedar Point in the Midwest, Universal and Disney, I mean, are classic examples of updating. You know, they're racing against one another. Disney is introducing Star Wars this year, Star Wars Land in California and Florida. And Universal is updating with a roller coaster. It's Harry Potter Land. So, you know, the audience gets tired fast. And there may, you know, if it's not going to be a sequel, they'll ride it as often as they can. They'll compare the experience, and then they want the next one.
Tell us a little bit about the difference between those parks of say, a Disneyland, a Disney World, and a Universal versus what would most of us think of as the amusement park that we grew up with, the neighborhood amusement park.
Well, I, you know, from experience, I grew up in Southern California. I remember when Walt Disney hosted the Sunday night program and told us all come to Disneyland.
Right.
And it was unique. It was charming. It was never crowded. Yes, it was more expensive than you would have paid for the local kiddie park. There's no doubt about that, but it was special. And then Disney World opens and it's sort of less Walt Disney designed than it is corporate designed. And so other companies, you know, tried to follow that example and just couldn't do it. Marriott got into the amusement park business, and Harcourt Brace. None of the corporate things worked. Universal was simply a quaint little studio tour in Hollywood, you know. But suddenly they learned, this is in the mid-60s, that they were making $1 million a year because everybody wanted to see how movies were made. But it wasn't enough. They'd come for the afternoon, then they'd go to Disneyland. And the Universal executive said, let's keep them on the lot. Let's add rides. And so everything sort of grew from there. And what we have today, I mean, these parks are so crowded, so expensive. Universal in California is actually more expensive than Disneyland. And the Florida parks, you know, you not only have to book your reservations well in advance for your hotel room, but you've got to book the time you go on the rides because the lines are so long.
Right.
And you can't just pop over for a hot dog. You can. It's available. But if you want to sit down for a meal, you need a reservation months in advance. I don't wish to criticize, but it takes a bit of the fun out of it.
Yeah, there's little spontaneity in any of that.
Right.
I mean, you have to book your rides, you have to book your meals. Let us talk for a moment about some of these old parks that were then gobbled up by the corporates. I mean, here in our region, we had the Great Escape in Lake George, and then that gets sold off to Six Flags. But that park prior to that had a very long life,
and a charmed life. But also, you know, what was introduced starting in the late 70s, insurance premiums became so expensive that only a corporation could afford them. You know, Great Adventure in New Jersey was started by Warner LeRoy, who opened Maxwell's Plum and ran Tavern on the Green and the Russian Tea Room. And it was a real fantasy land that Warner really thought was going to be its own Disney World. But, you know, after the first year, he turned management over to Six Flags and eventually ownership. And, you know, under these corporate banners, they do lose some personality.
Okay, so loss of personality. You talk about this also, and as we were discussing the Cyclone a moment ago, I grew up outside of Philadelphia. We had two parks. One was Dorney Park, and the other one was Knoebels.
Right. Right. Knoebels is still the charming, wonderful place it always was, and it has great food, and I can't say enough good about Knoebels.
It's free. I mean,
yeah.
To get in.
And
I mean,
reasonable, and you can take your dog.
Yeah, that's great.
That's not
and,
on the ride.
Well, no. But and this is the best thing for me, this was always the case in Knoebels, because my dad would bring me up there. And to teach me how to catch the ring on the carousel, and it's one of the you talk about insurance premiums. It's one of the few that still allows you the opportunity to get your arm torn off.
Right, this is correct. And the flying horses on Martha's Vineyard is another, and that's the oldest carousel in the United States.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a lost art, catching the brass ring. People don't even know what it means. It's like, you know, saying, you sound like a broken record. People don't get the reference.
And there was an arm, a stationary arm that would deposit rings, and you would be on the
mostly
outside.
Mostly lead. Right?
Yes. Well, sure. And then you would be on the outside of the horse. Those horses, most cases in the traditional carousels, would not go up and down. They were stationary,
and
you would lean off and not really. Yes, grab, I guess, is the proper term. You almost pinch them more than anything else. And mostly lead, but then if you get the gold ring, the brass ring, you get a free ride.
Ride for free, again.
Dorney Park was the other one. This is Solomon Dorney, and then that gets sold, right?
That was begun as a fishing hole, right? That's owned by a Spanish corporation now.
And you also, in this book, which I love, if you also go through the rides that we have come to love, the Whip,
there's one at Ride Playland still, very much as it was in the early 1900s.
Featured in the movie Big. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
I get excited when I hear the Whip.
The Whip, Dodge of Cars. That's
the ride. The ride.
That was what my father always called them, were Dodge of Cars.
Oh, yeah. And there were two, I mean, these inventors stole from one another. And there were all sorts of patent suits, but, it's still the ride we know and love. That's really a perennial, that one.
The good old Dodge. Yeah, the old fastened bumper cars.
Every kid wants to drive until he's old enough to drive, or she is old enough to drive. It's also a way of, turning the wheel and banging into your parents.
So how optimistic are you about the future of the amusement park?
I'm very optimistic. They're not cheap. And they're doing very well, and there are currently 1,000 of them in the entire world. I went to Dubai. I was the first journalist inside Shanghai Disneyland. It's spectacular. And they get better, bigger and better. And I am very optimistic. People want to have fun. You're not going to get it putting a headset in front of your eyes, and you know, you could be at home and pretend you're flying through space. But there's something about, you know, participating with other people. This is a group experience, and you know, they're unique. And let's face it, more and more, reality is so terrible that these escapes into fantasies are just welcome reliefs. Sign me up.
Absolutely. The name of the book is The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. I should mention, it's probably obvious if anyone knows the work of Black Dog and Leventhal, but the book is gorgeous. It's just a beautifully put together volume. Yeah.
Thank you.
Again, Stephen Silverman is the author. The name of the book is The Amusement Park. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thanks a million.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Amusement Park, published by Black Dog and Leventhal. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.